Welcome to All Souls Forum here on KKFI. I'm your host, Christina Frazier. Did you vote in the last election? Do you vote in your local and state elections? Chances are, if you listen to this show, you do, but 4 out of 10 eligible voters choose not to vote. Tonight, our speaker, Michael Smith, PhD professor of political science and chair at Emporia State University, will discuss his research and perspective on why voters choose not to vote, and his ideas on how to find ways to get more people interested in our political system. This show was recorded on February 10th at All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church here in Kansas City, Missouri. Our show begins with the speaker's presentation, followed by a short break, and then concludes with the question and answer part of the program. Thanks for tuning in. Now let's join the conversation here at 90.1 FM KKFI.
Welcome to All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church. The purpose of the forum is the discussion of significant issues, especially those which involve ethical values in the contemporary world. Michael Smith is a professor of political science and chair of social services at Emporia State University. He teaches classes on state and local politics, campaigns and elections, political philosophy, legislative politics, and nonprofit management. His newest book, State Voting Laws in America, Historical Statutes and Their Modern Implications, is co-authored with Chapman Rackaway and Kevin Anderson. He writes regularly for the Insight Kansas Group, publishing monthly columns in the Wichita Eagle and other newspapers around the state, and appearing several times per year on KTW's I've Got Issues to analyze Kansas politics. He has leadership training from both Kansas Leadership Center and the Gamali Foundation. He has worked on several political campaigns, including a come-from-behind victory with our dear friend, Dr. Charles Wheeler, a former Kansas City mayor, who won a come-from-behind Senate seat in 2002. Please help me welcome Professor Michael Smith.
Thank you very much for having me. This is probably more information than you need, but I actually live here, not here in the church, but here in Kansas City. I do stay overnight in Emporia when I'm there, but my wife's job is, and so this is home. And I've also, Linda mentioned Gamaliel training. I've had the leadership and the advanced leadership training in Gamaliel. And I used to be very active in Moore Squared. I'm not anymore. I go to the banquet, things like that. But we have a lot of overlap here in our interests. Now, with regards to the topic, I was asked to speak on why don't people vote. We may need to start by recasting the question into why do people vote. And let me explain that. This is fun. I feel like I'm giving a TED Talk. Let me start here. I don't know about you, although I would hazard a guess because you're here on an icy Sunday morning. I love politics. I always have. I grew up with it. My father loved history. My mother loved politics. So I got a little bit of both, maybe more than a little bit. I wish I could vote when I was 14 years old. I got very involved in those campaigns, even did some campaign activities, went to the Reagan-Mondale debates when they were here in Kansas City, sat in the overflow room and so forth, and it was a good time. And it's hard for me intuitively to understand why everybody doesn't love politics, because it's just so cool. The idea that you can take action and actually see the results of your work is very empowering for me. Even when I'm mad, I want to get involved. I want to do something about it. I want to say something, hopefully rational. So the downside to that is that, sure, I love politics. I suspect many of you love politics, but most people don't. Most people don't. Most people would rather be doing something else. It's not that they've been disillusioned, that say they, you know, one of the arguments will come up periodically is, well, the problem is the two parties. If we had a multi-party system, more people would participate. That's probably true, but only to an extent. The vast majority of non-participants don't non-participate because they're frustrated, because they wish there were a more active Green Party or a more active Libertarian Party or what have you. They don't participate because they have no interest in politics. Again, totally foreign concept to me. I don't get it, but it just isn't compelling for them. They'd rather watch professional sports. They'd rather go shopping. They'd rather spend time with family. They'd rather pursue hobbies or work hard and hope to ideally get ahead at work or, failing that, at least keep their jobs. They just don't invest in politics. And so what do we make of that? Well, those voters probably, they're not all the same, of course. And there's more than one way to break the group down. There's one population, and I don't, some of these are non-voters. Well, yeah, some of them are non-voters. Yeah, they absolutely are. And some of them may actually vote, but they're not happy about it. And those are the folks that are upset or disappointed with the political system. And the what for me is the conventional wisdom in political science, if you go read this book, I'm going to warn you up front, it's a little cynical, but it's a good read, and it does leave us with hope. We have to think differently. It's a book called Stealth Democracy by John Hibbing and Elizabeth Tice Morse, who teach up at the University of Nebraska. And they did a whole bunch of polls and focus groups and with this question about political participation. Who does, who doesn't? Why do the people who do it? Why do the people who don't do it, not do it? And that's not the first time it's ever been tackled, but it's one of the most recent, really comprehensive studies of the question. And essentially what they found is that many of the voters or non-voters that they interviewed, and by the way, non-voters are very hard to study, because if they don't vote, they probably don't answer surveys or go to focus groups either. It's one of the greatest, most vexing problems in political science. We'd love to study that population. They have no interest in being studied. Why would someone answer a poll and explain that they're not going to vote? In fact, people who lie to the pollsters is a real problem. We have to corroborate the data by going to their local election boards and seeing if they actually vote. And there's always a percentage of people who said they vote and they voted and they didn't. There's also a percentage of people who were probably motivated to vote by the poll. In other words, had they not been polled and reminded that the elections were coming up, they probably wouldn't have voted. So all that gets really interesting. But here's the bottom line. You've got different levels of political participation. You've got folks like me, and again, and I know I'm being presumptuous, but I know Unitarians. Many of you that are really into it. And we hit those benchmarks for the really involved voters. And one of those benchmarks include things like, do you vote in local elections, such as the Kansas and Missouri mayoral primary and general election coming up? Vast majority of people don't. But us political junkies, we do. We vote in those low turnout elections. Party primaries, same deal. Most Americans don't participate in those, but the real political hardcore, they do. They do. And so that's one measure of that very high involvement. The other one is, do you take political activities other than voting? Put a yard sign out, circulate the petition. You know, I have a friend from my home church. It's Kansas City UCC, used to be Country Club UCC. And every time I see her, she's got a new petition. You know, it's gotten to the point where I just say, oh, Jan, what are we petitioning for today? Well, let me tell you, sometimes she has two. That's another form of involvement, the petitioning, the yard signs, the bumper stickers, phone banking, talk to the neighbors, you know the drill. Again, this is a pretty small minority, a pretty small subset of the Americans who could vote. So what about everybody else? You've got a population that vote, even in some of those lower turnout elections, at least the midterms, like we had late last year. But that is the extent of their involvement. They'll do presidential elections, they'll do midterms, but after that, okay, they're done. Then you've got a population that only votes in presidential elections, and there are people within that population that are not even aware of other elections. With midterms and things like that, we always run into people that didn't know an election was being held. And again, when you take the political science hat off and put the Michael hat on, or whatever your name is, you say, well, how's that possible? It's all over the news. That's right. And there's a large population of Americans that don't watch any news or listen to or consume any type of news media at all. So, you know, when you say, I don't understand how they didn't know there was an election, it was on the news, you just answered your own question. Those folks were binge-watching Netflix or watching sports or what have you. They may see something on social media. We're not even going to touch that today. and so you forget that you select your audiences. So for folks that are politically plugged in, this stuff is pervasive. Can't turn the TV on, can't log onto your computer, even take out your smartphone without getting some update. But that's really not representative of the American people. What do those folks want? Those folks that don't vote. One argument is they want to be left alone. That's kind of a classic old argument, to heck with voter turnout. They wanted to vote, they would have. They chose not to. But we're not really happy with that, because there are issues of democracy there. For example, and this, I feel bad using this because it's so badly overused, but it is the go-to example. But when Adolf Hitler rose to power, he initially was elected, scary thought. Of course, he later ended election, so he couldn't be voted out of office. So, but he originally got in there by being elected. And what he did was mobilize people that don't vote, particularly small farmers who were very upset with the choices they had. And Hitler looked pretty good. So there's this underlying fear that if you just have this population of people that are just free radicals, they're just out there, they're not in a party, they're not in a campaign, they don't come to forums like this one, and you just say, well, that's their choice, well, somebody's going to mobilize them, and it may not be somebody that we like. It may not be somebody who's pro-democracy. So that's one of the reasons why it's not okay to just say, it's free country, your choice. What Hibbing and Tice-Morse found with either people that vote sometimes, but they're not happy about it, and people that don't vote, after going through all this trouble, including paying people for participating in focus groups and so forth, is that they do not want a deep democracy. In other words, they don't want every decision that the local congresswoman or congressman makes to be done in some town hall meeting. They don't even like town hall meetings. They don't want to be consulted on every issue. Maybe some of the big ones, but not every issue. They want what we call in the biz the trustee, or the Burkean representative, and honoring the philosopher and member of parliament in the UK, Edmund Burke. And that's the idea. You elect someone you trust, character, experience, and then they need to go and make some decisions, and then they can come home and run for re-election. If you think they did a bad job, well, vote them out of office. Vote for somebody else. It's a little bit like what you may be familiar with from Missouri and Kansas, parts of Kansas, including this area, which is the Missouri, this is actually what it's called, the Missouri Nonpartisan Court Plan for Judges, where you get the judge in there as appointed from a list given to the governor, and then you can vote on whether or not to retain them in office. Do you follow in great detail what every judge coming up for retention vote does to make an informed choice? Odds are that you do not do that. Some people leave that part of the ballot blank. Some people go with the thinking that I haven't heard anything bad, so it's probably okay. And some people vote against all of them, just sort of a throw the bums out, we need some new blood in there kind of activity. The people who have probably never heard of most of these judges but vote yes on retention generally prevail, and these judges are retained. Well, that's kind of what our non-voters told Hibbing and Tice-Morse that they want. Get somebody in there who will do a good job. Do whatever you need to do. I don't know all these technical details about how to design a bridge or how much money should be spent on certain social services, because that averts the need to spend money on other social services. I don't know. Just go do a good job, and we'll see you in a couple years, and we'll see if we think you should serve another term. The sort of trustee or Burkean approach. But there's one exception, and it's a big one. And if this bar isn't cleared, then these voters are either not going to participate or they will vote out a lot of the incumbents, which could mean some of the most experienced people. Hibbing and Tice Morse found that there is absolutely a crazy button for these voters. It really flips their trigger. They can't stand it. And I think a lot of voters feel this way too, but vote anyway for a variety of reasons. And that trigger is if they perceive elected officials as enriching themselves with their public position. If they see themselves pocketing money from well-connected interest groups, if they think their member of Congress is going to retire from Congress, go through the revolving door, and set up their own lobbying firm. Expensive vacations, leadership PACs, which is some of that money can be used for perks as opposed to a traditional political action committee or PAC where that's spent on the campaign itself. Leadership PACs are sort of a workaround where you actually can do plane trips and stuff like this. And the non-voters really hate that. And so they're looking for somebody that we can trust, that's not going to come back to us every time and say, well, I have a question for you about utilities regulation. I think the light should come on when I flip the switch. I don't know. They're not looking to have a town hall meeting on everything. Now, a few things that are of particular importance, sure. But they're not going to do that unless they trust the person is receiving a salary, because it's a full-time job, living on that salary. If they're married, it's a two-income couple. Maybe the spouse earns income in some way that's totally disconnected from the other spouse's political career. Maybe you've got a member of Congress who's married to someone who is a nurse, or a member of Congress who's married to someone who is a truck driver. In other words, the spouse's employment doesn't have anything to do with what the public official does for a living. We all know that that's not how it's perceived, and there's some truth in the cynicism that there is a revolving door. That there are a lot of spouses that get sweetheart deals working for law firms and lobbying firms because they're married to someone who's in office and so forth. And that's the one thing that non-voters and marginal voters told Hibbing and Tice Morse, we're not having this. It's if you profit from your position in public office, you're done. We will trust you on the other issues, but that is their one absolute must-have. And clearly, we're not doing a very good job with that, because both the perceptions and I would say the reality are that public officials do love to take advantage of their political position, past or current, and enrich themselves in other ways besides simply being eligible to receive a paycheck and eventually a pension plus health care. And so probably the single best thing we could do if your goal is to raise voter turnout, which I gather it is to tackle this issue, this perception that there's this corruption, this culture of corruption whereby people profit off their service in office. That seems to be the switch point for a lot of these voters who are at least willing to consider the possibility of voting. Now, having said that, though, there's a second problem, and this problem lies with the non-voters themselves. Now, is there a revolving door in D.C.? You bet. Do people leave Congress and set up their own lobbying firms? You bet. Do people in Washington, D.C. live very differently from the way most of their constituents do? I think we know the answer is yes. Many, maybe not all, but many. Now, it's also a very grueling job. It's not an easy job. And it's not easy to maintain two homes, one of which is in Washington, D.C., which has insanely high real estate costs. But even taking that into account, there's stuff going on that most Americans disapprove of. But, unfortunately, it gets confused because there's a second piece. And that second piece doesn't just apply to politics. It applies to a whole bunch of stuff. But it's something called the Dunning-Kruger effect. And named after a couple of professors. It's recent. I mean, they're alive and researching and working today. And two professors, obviously, Dunning and Kruger. And what they discovered in their psychological research is that often the people that are the most confident that they know something are the ones who know the least. There's an inverse relationship between thinking, yeah, I've got this, and actually having it. This is no surprise to people that work in academia. We see this all the time. So I don't need college algebra. I already studied it. Great, take the test out of it. You know what comes next, right? You don't know college algebra. That's why you need it. The person that says, I'm scared to take it, I struggle with it in high school, but I'm going to do my best, they'll probably be fine. The one that says, I don't understand why you're making me take this, I don't need this, that's the one that probably doesn't know the material. There's a Dunning-Kruger effect in politics, big time. And so, on the one hand, there is stuff going on in Washington, D.C., and Jeff City, and Topeka, and Austin, and Sacramento that's not good. It's true. It's true. And the news media will do stories about it, and blah, blah, blah. But then you also have this Dunning-Kruger piece with many voters, which works something like this. You know why I don't vote? Because all politicians are liars and they're all corrupt. Really? I didn't realize that Congressman Cleaver had done something corrupt. Could you give me a specific example of something he did? Oh, no, you don't have to say. They're all liars. They're all corrupt. I don't know who my congressman is. Why would I learn that when they're all liars and they're all corrupt? Well, what about Congresswoman Davids? I mean, she's new in office. Has she done something unethical? No, you don't understand. They're all liars. They're all corrupt. AKA, I have no idea what I'm talking about. But rather than just look you in the eye and say, I'm going to shirk my civic duty, I'm going to make up an excuse that I can't back up because that's my excuse. And you got to be careful with these voters because you come in here with your campaign finance reform, sweeping elections law like Missouri voters passed last year or whatever you want to do. Now, for one thing, all those laws have loopholes. It seems inevitable. But the other piece is you're not going to convince the Dunning-Kruger voters because they're not really disengaged because they think the system is corrupt. They're disengaged because they don't care and don't want to expend any effort. And so they use that old trope that goes back for centuries that all politicians are corrupt as an excuse for their non-participation. Presenting them with facts like your member of Congress has never been indicted for anything is completely irrelevant to them. They just want their excuse to continue shirking their civic duty. So don't try to convince them with specifics that the system isn't corrupt. You're just taking away their excuse for non-participation. But it's just the nature of, I don't know, our culture, all cultures being human, that we're not always wild about just straight up looking someone in the eye and saying no. I know I probably should vote, but I'm not going to. So we have to have a cover story, and politicians have been belittled and derided and hated, and sometimes they deserve it, for millennia. And so that's a handy meme that you can grab. You don't know who your congressman is. You don't know if they've ever been indicted for anything, but you know that all politicians are corrupt. Nothing new about this, right? Mark Twain said, suppose you were a member of Congress, suppose you were an idiot, but I repeat myself. So you can always reach out and grab that meme, even if you have no idea. You can't name any specific examples, or the examples you use happened 20 years ago, or they involve someone that doesn't represent you, that's another congressional district. That's not your member of Congress. That doesn't have anything to do with it. Your member of Congress is probably fine. But don't let these voters get you down. What we want to do is we want to find those voters that genuinely are interested, genuinely are willing, and then kind of pull them in. We can convince them that it's our civic duty. You know, just do it. It's just a responsibility. Just do it, like putting stuff in the recycling bin or whatever. Just do it. We can lower the information costs. This is another huge issue. If you didn't grow up around politics, if your parents didn't vote, I can tell you as a college professor, our students are not getting this in K-12 schools. It's scary how little they know about civics and history. Then you have no tools with which to even evaluate the parties or candidates or local office or whether or not politicians are corrupt even. There's nothing in your toolbox. So how would you even know how you could say, well, I think this member of Congress is doing a pretty good job, but this one over here really is corrupt. It should be voted out of office. If you have nothing in your toolbox with which to evaluate that. And so political science because we like to think we're really a science and we like to get all academic-y, you know, we will say information costs. It costs to acquire information. Does it cost to register and vote? Yes, and that's another issue. And I'm very much in favor of things like Election Day voter registration to bring those costs down. Putting polling places where they're more accessible, shortening the lines. I'm all for it. I'm all for it. In fact, there's legislation pending in the U.S. House right now that would encourage the states to do a lot of that. So that's great. And that will boost the voter turnout, probably 5% plus or minus. So go for it, absolutely. And I support these things. But 5% is still a little low, considering that most Americans don't vote at all outside the presidential elections. And about a third of us don't vote at all, period, even in the presidential elections. So that's great to do Election Day voter registration. The city of Sandusky, Ohio, is now doing Election Day as a holiday, which is another idea that's been bandied about. Those ideas can help. They really can make a difference because they lower the cost. I'm not talking about financial. Could be financial if you have to order a copy of your birth certificate or something before that law was stayed. It could be financial. There could be some money out of pocket for these things. But a lot of it is the time cost. It takes time to figure out where you're voting, to stand in line, and to mark the ballot and to vote. And, of course, on Election Day, if you vote on Election Day, which fewer and fewer Americans do, by the way, because of early voting, but if you do, then, you know, those lines can be kind of long. And people, it's a weekday. People are trying to get to work. But the greater cost is actually not the line or the marking the ballot or the showing your ID. The greater cost is getting the information to cast an informed vote. That's really the key is, okay, I made it to the polls. Here I am. I'm registered. Got my ID. But who do I vote for? And this is where, you know, political scientists, we can be real jerks. Because if political science is anything, we're a bunch of debunkers. We're wild about debunking. You know that thing you believe? Not true. Nope. Nope. You thought Election Day registration was going to save us? Nope. You might get 5% more. You thought your party was not the majority in the U.S. House because of gerrymandering? Nope. A few seats, yeah. But that wasn't the reason. And we're just... we're obnoxious with this, with the debunking. Well, here's some more. Oftentimes, and we see this with Dunning-Kruger voters and non-voters, they will latch onto this idea. You've heard this. You've heard this. I don't vote for the party. I vote for the person. I'm not going to let some political party tell me how to vote. Okay. I get it that... there are voters who feel that neither of the two parties represent them very well. And many other democracies do have multi-party systems. And we love to study that. Pretty neat to have the, more than the two and have to build coalitions and so forth. Most of continental Europe is that way, for example. South Korea, I could go on and on. So there are voters like that. They know the two parties and they're not within that spectrum. They're over here, they're over here, they're in the middle, they're over here, and they don't fit. The vast majority of those, I don't vote for the party, I vote for the person voters, are not in that camp. And when I say the vast majority, I mean 95%. The vast majority of those voters are Dunning-Kruger voters, or non-voters, who don't understand why people typically support a party because they have no idea what the two parties stand for. And those of us that do typically find we usually line up with one of the two parties. We're not exactly in the middle. Probably 70% plus. These days, probably more like 80 to 90% plus. Oh, sure, we could nitpick and say, you know that one candidate I voted for? She wasn't perfect. There were a couple things, you know, I wish she wouldn't take that stand, or I wish she'd be a little stronger over here. But the bottom line is, you're in that voting booth. It's time to mark the ballot. The vast majority of people... will, if they know where they stand and where the parties stand, line up on one side or the other. Not 100%, but not 50-50 either. Dunning-Kruger voters and non-voters love to call people who support the parties ignorant. You're so stupid. You let a party do your thinking for you. You should vote for the person. Facts show that voters that consider themselves Democrats or Republicans are not the least, they're the most informed voters. They know where they stand, they know where the parties stand, and they line up with one of the parties, partly because if the parties don't have a majority, they're not going to be able to pass legislation. So if you just vote for some individual candidates, the agenda you would like to see passed probably isn't going to get passed. Sure, you can grumble and grouse about, why'd they have to nominate him? I don't know. I wish that the party I usually supported somebody else. But the reality is that you're not, and I don't mean you, this is a royal you, not you all. You're not fooling anybody with your all, I vote for the party, not the person, and I don't know why you would let a party do your thinking for you. In reality, most people who vote pretty partisan do it because they know where the parties stand and which one's closer to their own views. And there are ways to express dissatisfaction with the party you normally support, such as voting in the primary elections, which is a much better strategy. Just show up and vote in the primaries than all this vote for the person, not the party nonsense. And if you really want competitive third parties, we can talk about Maine, which has become the first state in the United States to institute ranked choice voting, where you can vote and then essentially vote for the backup candidate. So the classic example, let's say you support the Green Party, and you really want to vote for the Green Party, but you think they're probably not going to win, and maybe, in my hypothetical, your second choice would be the Democrats, but you feel kind of trapped. I want to vote for the Green Party. Go ahead. And then rank it in order, one Green, two Democrats, so that if the Green Party doesn't have enough votes for to win any offices, they'll just switch your voter preference over to number two. And that way you can have the best of both worlds. And what that does is it boosts voting for those third parties, because you've got your Greens, you've got your Libertarians. Those are the two biggest parties other than the big two in this country, the Greens and the Libertarians, who have not been voting that way because they're afraid of wasting a vote. Now you're good. Just mark that number two in your backup and go home, whistling all the way home, because you got to do what you wanted, vote for your favorite candidate and cast a backup. And at the same time, it could be that there are enough votes cast that way that those third parties will pick up a few seats and we'll have some Greens and some Libertarians and some others in there. So to sort of wrap up, number one, I'm sympathetic to the idea of more than two political parties, but you have to understand you have to change the Constitution. Definitely the state constitutions, possibly even the federal. It's not just a matter of telling voters that they should vote for third-party candidates. When people say you're likely to be casting a wasted vote, they're right. They're not being manipulative. They're not cynical political insiders who trying to squish democracy. They're just right. You probably are. But if this is important to you, then things like ranked choice voting deserve a second look. There are democracies that do fine with more than two parties. So the issue is not we have to have only two parties. The issue is if you want more than two, what are the right ways and the wrong ways to go about doing that? That's the first thing. The second thing is non-voters really hate corruption. That seems to be their big thing. It's not an issue thing, or I don't like where you stand on tariffs, or I don't like where you stand on these other issues. It's more that I don't like politicians that are corrupt, defined as pocketing the money. I don't want House of Cards to be real. And that's probably why the show was so popular, is because people didn't so much say, wow, this is great fiction, as they said, I know these characters are fiction, but there's a lot of truth in this. On the other hand, they can get mixed up with these Dunning-Kruger voters who will never be convinced because they're not really not voting because they are outraged about corruption. They're not voting, and they pulling up the old meme of the corrupt politician is a handy way to rationalize that when people come to them and saying, hey, how about voting? So we have to find the voters who genuinely are upset about corruption and give them a reason to, and of course we have to get it passed, to believe that steps are being taken to make the system less corrupt. And then we also have to know that some of those voters are not going to stick with it because they're not so much genuinely outraged about corruption as they are just needing to come up with some excuse to not vote. And so a distinction there is really important. That's what I got. Been asked to take questions?
All right. Thank you. Feel free to come up and ask a question. Let's make sure everybody has a turn before we go on to second questions. And this is a political sort of discussion, so try to keep it down to questions and not speeches.
You made a reference to K through 12 educations relating to civics.
I did.
I don't see much of an upswelling of public concern about how we want to change our educational system, except maybe there's an emphasis on STEM and there's somewhat of an emphasis on getting women into a more into a different role within education and so on.
Sure.
But what would you personally like to see as part of a civics effort K through 12 or even after K through 12? What specific coursework or generalized coursework would you like to see as a part of what we would term civics?
Right. I've worked on this. It's been a few years, but the perspective I was working from when I worked on some civic curricula was that one of the craziest things about American politics, and I absolutely believe this starts in K-12, is that we've got everything flipped so completely upside down. Turn on that TV, log onto your computer, pull your smartphone out of your pocket, and what do you hear people talking about? The president and Congress. The president did this. Congress is investigating that. Prosecutor Mueller did this. The president tweeted that. There's ice. There's a sheet of ice covering the streets out there. People could be in some very bad accidents on foot or in their cars. Are the president and Congress going to fix that? The things that affect your daily life are done by the state and local governments. The vast majority, there's a lot of talk about mass incarceration right now, and there should be. I'm glad we're talking about it. Where is it happening? The vast majority of prisoners in this country are in state facilities and local jails. Federal portion is quite small. So we get all wrapped up because Trump said something inappropriate about crime, when the reality is we should care a lot more what Laura Kelly and Mike Parson have to say about crime than we do about what Trump has to say about crime, because they are the chief executives in the places where most people who are in prison are there. So to get into the K-12, what I did, I worked with the former U.S. Senator from Florida, Bob Graham. He's a really cool guy. And we're trying to flip the civics curriculum. So he said, you know, would you take 2 seconds and just stop talking about Trump and his latest tweets? Or Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and she took a picture of herself dancing. Let's take a break from that. Let's go outside and let's notice that you're walking in the street when you're coming to school because there's no sidewalk there. Who do I need to contact? Get that sidewalk in there. I don't want these kids being run over by cars. And it isn't Donald Trump, and it isn't Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. It's your member of the city council. It's your member of the county commission. It may be your mayor. And so what we try to do is to get back to the fundamentals. Who's going to fill the pothole? Who's going to put in the sidewalk? Who's going to fund that clinic in your school that provides services for people that don't have any other access to those services, and make sure that it gets funded, or make sure that the grant comes through that pays for it? Who's going to make sure that your teacher doesn't get so demoralized that they retire early, your favorite teacher? It isn't the president, and it isn't members of Congress. So if what I hope we can do for these kids is get them back to the local. Let's talk about potholes. Let's talk about sidewalks. Let's talk about traffic signals. Let's talk about schools. And start with a ground-up civics, whereas right now, generally, we immediately start talking about the president and Congress and the Supreme Court. And we need to rethink that. And I honestly think that a lot of Americans, young and old, when they step in the pothole, when they twist their ankle, when they slide on the ice, they don't even think, this is a local government issue. My local government has failed me. I am going to contact my member of the city council right now. And that's really too bad, because that's where politics happens in our lives most of the time.
It's not exactly corruption, legally speaking, but in the last 20 years or so, I've become aware of ex-politicians and ex-public servants at the national level running around the country and running around the world even, making one-hour speeches and getting $200,000. That was the case with the Clintons. And my question to you, they're not the only ones, but they were doing that very recently. I presume they still are. But do you think that that category of non-voters, a certain percentage, came out in anger because they perceived that Hillary was either for her own acts or her husband's, that she lost some or lost votes, or the other side got votes because of that activity?
I think so. I don't have the data to back it up. So this is just me talking. It's not political science talking. But I have a little bit different take on Hillary Clinton's emails. Many Hillary supporters, and I supported her as well, but the thinking is that, well, the problem was that people didn't trust her because of she didn't want to disclose those emails. I have a little bit different, and I like to think more political science-y take on that, which is, well, it's an idea called salience. It's which issues are important to you. And so when the email thing broke, and could have been handled a lot better, what it did, in my view, was it made salient this issue that goes all the way back to things like the Rose Law Firm's billing records in the 1990s. So, oh yeah, they're corrupt. This is a reminder. And I don't like it, being that I support the Democratic Party myself, I don't like it when Democrats do this thing where they latch onto, you know, we should have handled the emails better, or we shouldn't have let the Republicans spin the emails, or the news media wasn't fair to us about the emails, because to me, that's looking at the individual tree. And the forest is this idea, yeah, I think you articulated it just fine, that it's not just that she doesn't want to disclose emails and she had her own server. It's this idea that both Clintons are part of this sort of pervasive culture, which the other piece I wanted to mention, because you nailed something I think is really important, and I failed to define corruption, and so let me do that now. I don't necessarily mean breaking the law. It could be. It absolutely could be breaking the law, of campaign finance laws and things. Oh, yeah, definitely. But the corruption is more this sense that, I mean, I'm here public speaking right now. Nobody's giving me $200,000. Right. It's a sense that it may be perfectly legal. You may not be breaking law one, but there's just something that's not right about it. You already get a pension. You're a retired president of the United States and a retired first lady, retired secretary of state, U.S. senator. You get a pension. You don't need that money. And so is it legal? Yes. Do I like it? No. And I think what would have happened, and I don't know, because we can't hold another election as a counterfactual. But what happened is the election returns would have shifted just slightly. I think the vast majority of your Trump voters, they knew who they were voting for. Clinton, same deal. But I think you had this little sliver that either didn't vote or that said, I just can't do it because this corruption stuff goes all the way back to when Bill Clinton was president. And or earlier. And I just don't trust them.
So I really like how you brought up mass incarceration.
Sure.
Because I do think that that also ties into voting, because if you guys aren't aware here, Florida just gave back all of the rights to people who have been incarcerated to their felons. They voted for that, which I think is really great. And I think that that is something that some people see can really affect voting, but I wanted to know your take on it. Like, what do you think of, you know, the people who've obviously served their time, who are now out? Like this, my dad is a great example. He did something when he was 17, and he was interested in politics, but he could never vote because he lived in Florida before that had passed. So.
Well, I am supportive of what Florida did. That's just where I stand. Now, in terms of your election turnout, for it to make a difference, it has to be really close. The thing is, though, some elections are really close. And so, all right, maybe restoring full voting rights to someone who's been convicted of a felony after they've done incarceration, parole, probation would only boost voter turnout by a few points. But for a really close election, and we certainly have those, that might be the margin. The other thing I would address is this. There's a second problem, which may even be worse. And that problem is that people don't understand what the law is. In Missouri and Kansas, you can fully restore your voting rights after sentencing, serving the sentence, parole, probation. I can't tell you how many people I've run into that think they've lost their voting rights for life, and they haven't. And I suspect that there are even people like parole officers that tell them this, and it's not true. Lots of states where you can have your voting rights restored, people don't because they think they can't. And so you've got your Floridas and Georgia, Virginia, Iowa now, unfortunately, in my opinion, where you do lose your voting rights for life. But you've also got all these states where you don't, but people think you do. And so there's an information piece here to reach those folks and say, I mean, even in Florida, and they had some of the most draconian laws of all, along with Georgia. And like I say, now Iowa, but that's recent. Even there, you could petition. Probably need the help of a lawyer, but there are legal aid societies that would help. You could petition. And so what really makes me sad is how many people have the right and don't know they have it. So that's another sleeper issue out there, that how little knowledge there is among people that have been convicted of felonies that they can restore their voting rights, even under the current law.
I have a two-part question. I think you've done an excellent job explaining why a lot of people don't vote. But my question to you is, do you think more people should vote? And there's an argument on both sides of that question. And if you do believe that more people should vote, what are the best practical recommendations you would make to achieve that goal? You've disparaged, for example, reforming gerrymandering and others as good measures. I mean, they're a good thing to do, but maybe not significantly impact voter turnout. So what would significantly increase voter participation?
That's a great question. There's an interesting observation, is sort of a paradox. Political science studies, late 1940s on, all show that probably the single best predictor of whether an individual is going to vote in the United States is their education level. More education, more vote. Second is probably family. And what we forget is it's not just that if your parents were Democrats, you're likely to be a Democrat. Republicans, you're likely to be a Republican. The thing that got lost in those statistics is if your parents didn't vote, you're likely not to vote either. And that group is bigger than either the Democrat or the Republican group, although not quite as big as both combined. And so the debate, you already know this, I can tell. The debate is, well, if we really bumped up voter turnout, would we bring out all these uninformed voters that have no idea what they're doing and would vote for candidates based on the sound of their last name or celebrity status or what have you, but not an issue-based vote? And ideally, we would want people to become more informed and be more likely to vote. We want to somehow bring them up together, because it's always easier said than done. This is where I'm really old school. It's a combination of old school and being a political scientist. Again, the debunking and all that, because whereas it's fashionable for voters to denounce parties, the traditional answer to your question is political parties. Who connects issues to candidates and mobilizes voters? Political parties do. And so we passed all this campaign finance law, a lot of it's good, I'm thinking more the national level, not the state so much, and designed to kind of rein in money. But unfortunately, it actually can weaken the parties in some ways. And so the best institution we've ever discovered that connect candidates, issues, and voter mobilizations are political parties. So I might challenge you a little bit to say, I share your goal of not just wanting to dump more people in the electorate. We want that informed vote piece coming up as well. We want to rise together. And I absolutely think that things like Election Day registration can tick it upward. And we know they can because some states do it, and we have the results. I like the way Oregon and Colorado and Washington do vote by mail. They've got all sorts of checks on voter fraud, never been any problems, and that's another solution. But instead of the conventional wisdom that you hear among just regular folks is, well, the problem is the parties. No, the solution is the parties. Those are the institutions that we need to do that. But again, just like with candidates, if they're perceived as corrupt, then that weakens that relationship for the voters because they think they're in it for themselves and not for the voters.
Your implicit answer to part one of my question was, yes, you think there should be more voter participation?
I do, yeah. But I totally get it that we can't just get more people registered. For one thing, if you register more voters, a lot of them don't show up and actually vote. But the other issue is that, how do I know who to vote for? And I know of no institution that does that better than parties.
First, I'd like to put in a plug for the League of Women Voters. We are having a mayoral candidate forum here at the church on March 9th. So spread the word for local participation. The League does a fantastic job of voter registration. We have spent many, many hours registering voters. But my question is, how do we know that all those people that we sign up actually get to the polls? I have wanted in the past to keep a list of those people and contact them before the election, and they've said, no, that's verboten. So how do we know? What can we do about these people that we sign up, but we don't know whether they get to the polls or not?
You actually can do that. And I know that over in Lawrence, the League of Women Voters has done some of that kind of work where they register and then they stick with it and say, hey, I just wanted to check and see if you had any questions or needed a ride to the polls. It can be done. Now, I don't know that you can keep copies of the petitions, but I think what you can do is just pull the voter registration list and keep your own records and then say, oh, yeah, I remember this household and what have you. You can do that. The get out the vote or the knock and drag campaigns absolutely is a good idea. And there are some interesting things we've learned about that. One is that face-to-face is better than phones. Ethnicity matters. If voters think that the person is the same ethnicity as them, they're more responsive. And so there's all sorts of research that can sort of help make better and worse decisions about how to do that kind of outreach.
Okay, one more quick question.
Okay. Well, I do want to know that League does have a follow-up now. Jan just happened to be on a team that didn't use it. After registering, if they'll give us an email address or a text, we send out a message saying, have you checked to make sure your registration was processed? These are all timed. The next one is, are you informed? Go to vote411.org and get informed about the coming candidates and issues. And then the third is, it's election time, go vote. So we are trying to do that. But my question is much more personal. I mean, it has nothing to do with the League of Women Voters. I know pure chauvinists, deep down hardcore male chauvinists, who will never vote for a woman. Has your research shown how many of those are out there in the voting population?
Not mine, but I've read others' research that's been published. You're right. It is an issue. It's hard to fix.
Okay, yeah, it sure is.
You know, it's interesting. The stereotypes don't always apply. So Kansas has one of the best records of electing women to public office of any state. Current governor is a woman, and not the first, but the third. Missouri is at zero, right? So it doesn't always fit the stereotypes because we see Kansas as conservative and so forth. But it may be generational. One issue that's come up that's sort of a stealthy one is that there have been efforts on the behalf of Republicans to demobilize African-American men, in other words, encourage them not to vote, by playing to some of these gender issues, including the Brett Kavanaugh hearings, including in Missouri. And they don't publicize that. So there are some you may not be able to convince. But if Kansas can have one of the best records in the United States of electing women, there's obviously hope, too. And, of course, Missouri has had a female U.S. senator. So it may be that that just goes in that block of voters that, yeah, we're going to skip them and mobilize some other voters instead.
And we won't go there, but maybe we could talk about rural versus urban voters in the library. Are you going to the library?
Okay, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I'll let you answer that.
Yeah, and I'm sorry, we just don't have time for another one. But we will be going into the library, so it can be a little more conversational, and you're more than welcome to come back and ask those. Let's thank Professor Smith. Thank you so much. That was wonderful. We do have,
oh, that's cool.
We have the $200,000, but yeah. We have a nice little blue cup for you.
This is nice. I like that.
Okay,
thank you.
Great. Thank you very much. Next week should be a very interesting forum. Dr. Rex Archer will be here, and you can see the title is Freeloading versus Civic Duties on Vaccinations and the Measles Epidemic Coming Back, and some real important discussion to happen there. You're also invited to stay for church if you'd like. We'd love to see you in the library and next Sunday. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. I hope you've enjoyed tonight's presentation, Who Votes, Who Doesn't, and Why, with Michael Smith. This program was recorded on Sunday, February 10th at All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church. All Souls Forum is edited and produced for broadcast by Christina Frazier. Our theme song was composed, performed, and recorded by musician Fred Potter. This program will be available for podcast within one day of broadcast on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. Remember, you can also find archived All Souls podcasts and many other interesting and enlightening public affairs programs produced by KKFI on the KKFI website. Thanks for joining us this evening, and we hope you tune in next week, same time, same place, when we will continue the conversation here at 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City's community radio station.